but for Spain. Eventually, a time came when Philip could only fail. If the Armada sank, he would be ruined for years to come. And even if the Armada triumphed, victory would come so dear that he would ruin himself trying to exploit it on English soil. Understand, no person or group is completely either weak or strong. Every army, no matter how invincible it seems, has a weak point, a place left unprotected or undeveloped. Size itself can be a weakness in the end. Meanwhile, even the weakest group has something it can build on, some hidden strength. Your goal in war is not simply to amass a stockpile of weapons, to increase your firepower so you can blast your enemy away. That is wasteful, expensive to build up, and leaves you vulnerable to guerrilla-style attacks. Going at your enemies blow by blow, strength against strength, is equally unstrategic. Instead, you must first assess their weak points. Internal political problems, low morale, shaky finances, overly centralized control, their leaders' megalomania. While carefully keeping your own weaknesses out of the fray and preserving your strength for the long haul, hit their Achilles heel again and again. Having their weaknesses exposed and preyed upon will demoralize them, and as they tire, new weaknesses will open up. By carefully calibrating strengths and weaknesses, you can bring down your Goliath with a slingshot. By Ovid. Abundance makes me poor. Keys to Warfare. Reality can be defined by a sharp series of limitations on every living thing, the final boundary being death. We have only so much energy to expend before we tire. Only so much in the way of food and resources is available to us. Our skills and capacities can go only so far. An animal lives within those limits. It did not try to fly higher or run faster or expend endless energy amassing a pile of food, for that would exhaust it and leave it vulnerable to attack. It simply tries to make the most of what it has. A cat, for instance, instinctively practices an economy of motion and gesture, never wasting effort. People who live in poverty, similarly, are acutely aware of their limits. Forced to make the most of what they have, they are endlessly inventive. Necessity has a powerful effect on their creativity. The problem faced by those of us who live in societies of abundance is that we lose a sense of limit. We are carefully shielded from death and can pass months, even years, without contemplating it. We imagine endless time at our disposal and slowly drift further from reality. We imagine endless energy to draw on, thinking we can get what we want simply by trying harder. We start to see everything as limitless. The goodwill of friends, the possibility of wealth and fame. A few more classes and books and we can extend our talents and skills to the point where we become different people. Technology can make anything achievable. Abundance makes us rich in dreams, for in dreams there are no limits. But it makes us poor in reality. It makes us soft and decadent, bored with what we have, and in need of constant shocks to remind us that we are alive. In life, you must be a warrior, and war requires realism. While others may find beauty in endless dreams, warriors find it in reality, in awareness of limits, in making the most of what they have. Like the cat, they look for the perfect economy of motion and gesture, the way to give their blows the greatest force with the least expenditure of effort. Their awareness that their days are numbered, that they could die at any time, grounds them in reality. There are things they can never do, talents they will never have, lofty goals they will never reach. That hardly bothers them. Warriors focus on what they do have, the strengths that they do possess, and that they must use creatively. Knowing when to slow down, to renew, to retrench, they outlast their opponents. They play for the long term. Through the final years of French colonial rule in Vietnam and on through the Vietnam War, The military leader of the Vietnamese insurgents was General Vo Nguyen Giap. In first the French and then the Americans, he faced an enemy with vastly superior resources, firepower, and training. His own army was a ragtag collection of peasants. They had morale, a deep sense of purpose, but little else. Giap had no trucks to carry supplies, and his communications were 19th century. Another general would have tried to catch up, and Giap had the opportunity. He had the offer of trucks, radios, weapons, and training from China, but he saw them as a trap. It wasn't only that he didn't want to spend his limited funds on such things. In the long run, he believed, all they would do was turn the North Vietnamese into a weaker version of their enemy. Instead, he chose to make the most of what he had, turning his army's weaknesses into virtues. Trucks could be spotted from the air, and the Americans could bomb them. But the Americans could not bomb supply lines they could not see. Exploiting his resources, then, Giap used a vast network of peasant coolies to carry supplies on their backs. When they came to a river, they would cross it on rope bridges hung just below the surface of the water. Right up to the end of the war, the Americans were still trying to figure out how North Vietnam supplied its armies in the field. Meanwhile, Giap developed hit-and-run guerrilla tactics that gave him enormous potential to disrupt American supply lines. To fight, move troops, and ferry supplies, the Americans used helicopters, which gave them tremendous mobility. But the war ultimately had to be fought on the ground, and Giap was endlessly inventive in using the jungle to neutralize American air power, disorient American foot soldiers, and camouflage his own troops. He could not hope to win a pitched battle against superior U.S. weaponry, so he put his effort into spectacular, symbolic, demoralizing attacks that would drive home the futility of the war when they appeared on American TV. With the minimum that he had, he created the maximum effect. Armies that seem to have the edge in money, resources, and firepower tend to be predictable. Relying on their equipment, instead of on knowledge and strategy, they grow mentally lazy. When problems arise, their solution is to amass more of what they already have. But it's not what you have that brings you victory, it's how you use it. When you have less, you are naturally more inventive. Creativity gives you an edge over enemies dependent on technology. You will learn more, be more adaptable, and you will outsmart them. Unable to waste your limited resources, you will use them well. Time will be your ally. If you have less than your enemy, do not despair. You can always turn the situation around by practicing perfect economy. If you and your enemy are equals, getting hold of more weaponry matters less than making better use of what you have. If you have more than your enemy, fighting economically is as important as ever. As Pablo Picasso said, even if you are wealthy, act poor. The poor are more inventive and often have more fun, because they value what they have and know their limits. Sometimes, in strategy, you have to ignore your greater strength and force yourself to get the maximum out of the minimum. Even if you have the technology, fight the peasant's war. This does not mean that you disarm or fail to exploit what advantages you may have in materiel. In Operation Desert Storm, the U.S. campaign against Iraq in 1991, American military strategists made full use of their superior technology, particularly in the air, but they did not depend on this for victory. They had learned the lesson of their debacle 20 years earlier in Vietnam, and their maneuvers showed the kind of deceptive feints and use of mobility associated with smaller guerrilla-like forces. This combination of advanced technology and creative flair proved devastating. War is a balance of ends and means. A general might have the best plan to achieve a certain end, but unless he has the means to accomplish it, his plan is worthless. Wise generals through the ages, then, have learned to begin by examining the means they have at hand and then to develop their strategy out of those tools. That is what made Hannibal a brilliant strategist. He would always think first of the givens, the makeup of his own army and of the enemy's, their respective proportions of cavalry and infantry, the terrain, his troops' morale, the weather. That would give him the foundation not only for his plan of attack, but for the ends he wanted to achieve in this particular encounter. Instead of being locked into a way of fighting, like so many generals, he constantly adjusted his ends to his means. That was the strategic advantage he used again and again. The next time you launch a campaign, try an experiment. Do not think about either your solid goals or your wishful dreams, and do not plan out your strategy on paper. Instead, think deeply about what you have, the tools and materials you will be working with. Ground yourself not in dreams and plans, but in reality. Think of your own skills, any political advantage you might have, the morale of your troops, how creatively you can use the means at your disposal. Then, out of that process, let your plans and goals blossom. Not only will your strategies be more realistic, they will be more inventive and forceful. Dreaming first of what you want, and then trying to find the means to reach it, is a recipe for exhaustion, waste, and defeat. Do not mistake cheapness for perfect economy. Armies have failed by spending too little, as often as by spending too much. When the British attacked Turkey during World War I, hoping to knock it out of the war and then attack Germany from the east, they began by sending a fleet to break through the Dardanelles Strait and head for the Turkish capital of Constantinople. The fleet made good progress, but even so, after several weeks, some ships had been sunk, more lives than expected had been lost, and the venture in general was proving costly. So, the British called off the naval campaign, deciding instead to land an army on the peninsula of Gallipoli and fight through by land. That route seemed safer and cheaper. But it turned into a months-long fiasco that cost thousands of lives and in the end led nowhere, for the Allies eventually gave up and pulled out their troops. Years later, Turkish documents were uncovered that revealed that the British fleet had been on the verge of success. In another day or two, it would have broken through, and Constantinople would probably have fallen. The whole course of the war might have been changed, but the British had over-economized. At the last moment, they had pulled their punches, worrying about cost. In the end, the cost of trying to win on the cheap wound up punitively expensive. Perfect economy, then, does not mean hoarding your resources. That is not economy, but stinginess, deadly in war. Perfect economy means finding a golden mean, a level at which your blows count but do not wear you out. Over-economizing will wear you out more, for the war will drag on, its costs growing, without your ever being able to deliver a knockout punch. Several tactics lend themselves to economy in fighting. First is the use of deception, which costs relatively little but can yield powerful results. During World War II, the Allies used a complicated series of deceptions to make the Germans expect an attack from many different directions, forcing them to spread themselves thin. Hitler's Russian campaign was much weakened by the need to keep troops in France and the Balkans to defend from attacks there, attacks that never came. Deception can be a great equalizer for the weaker side. Its arts include the gathering of intelligence, the spreading of misinformation, and the use of propaganda to make the war more unpopular within the enemy camp. Second, look for opponents you can beat. Avoid enemies who have nothing to lose. They will work to bring you down whatever it costs. In the 19th century, Otto von Bismarck built up Prussia's military power on the backs of weaker opponents such as the Danes. Easy victories enhance morale, develop your reputation, give you momentum, and most important, do not cost you much. There will be times when your calculations misfire. What had seemed to be an easy campaign turns out hard. Not everything can be foreseen. Not only is it important to pick your battles carefully then, but you must also know when to accept your losses and quit. In 1971, the boxers Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, both at the heights of their careers, met for the World Heavyweight Championship. It was a grueling match, one of the most exciting in history. Frazier won by a decision after nearly knocking out Ali in the 15th round. Both men suffered horribly in the fight. Both threw a lot of good punches. Wanting revenge, Ali gained a rematch in 1974. Another grueling 15-round affair, and won by a decision. Neither boxer was happy. Both wanted a more conclusive result, so they met again in 1975, in the famous Thrilla in Manila. This time, Ali won in the 14th round, but neither man was ever the same again. These three fights had taken too much out of them, shortening their careers. Pride and anger had overtaken their powers of reason. Do not fall into such a trap. Know when to stop. Do not soldier on out of frustration or pride. Too much is at stake. Finally, nothing in human affairs stays the same. Over time, either your efforts will tend to slow down, a kind of friction will build up, whether from unexpected exterior events or from your own actions, or momentum will help to move you forward. Wasting what you have will create friction, lowering your energy and morale. You are essentially slowing yourself down. Fighting economically, on the other hand, will build momentum. Think of it as finding your level, a perfect balance between what you are capable of and the task at hand. When the job you are doing is neither above nor below your talents, but at your level, you are neither exhausted nor bored and depressed. You suddenly have new energy and creativity. Fighting with perfect economy is like hitting that level. Less resistance in your path, greater energy unleashed. Oddly enough, knowing your limits will expand your limits. Getting the most out of what you have will let you have more. Reversal. There can never be any value in fighting uneconomically, but it is always a wise course to make your opponent waste as much of his resources as possible. This can be done through hit-and-run tactics, forcing him to expend energy chasing after you. Lure him into thinking that one big offensive will ruin you, then bog that offensive down in a protracted war in which he loses valuable time and resources. A frustrated opponent exhausting energy on punches he cannot land will soon make mistakes and open himself up to a vicious counterattack. Here are further reflections on the strategy of perfect economy. By Carl von Clausewitz. In the utilization of a theater of war, as in everything else, strategy calls for economy of strength. The less one can manage with, the better. But manage one must, and here, as in commerce, there is more to it than mere stinginess. From The Art of War, by Sun Tzu. He whom the ancients called an expert in battle gained victory where victory was easily gained. Thus the battle of the expert is never an exceptional victory, nor does it win him reputation for wisdom or credit for courage. His victories in battle are unerring. Unerring means that he acts where victory is certain and conquers an enemy that has already lost. From The Greek Myths, by Robert Graves. Achilles now routed the Trojans and pursued them toward the city, but his course, too, was run. Poseidon and Apollo pledged to avenge the deaths of Cygnus and Troilus and to punish certain insolent boasts that Achilles had uttered over Hector's corpse, took counsel together. Veiled with cloud and standing by the Sion gate, Apollo sought out Paris in the thick of battle, turned his bow, and guided the fatal shaft. It struck the one vulnerable part of Achilles' body, the right heel, and he died in agony. From the I Ching. Limitations are troublesome, but they are effective. If we live economically in normal times, we are prepared for times of want. To be sparing saves us from humiliation. Limitations are also indispensable in the regulation of world conditions. In nature, there are fixed limits for summer and winter, day and night, and these limits give the year its meaning. In the same way, economy, by setting fixed limits upon expenditures, acts to preserve property and prevent injury to the people. From Ecce Homo, by Friedrich Nietzsche. In all this, in selection of nutriment, of place and climate, of recreation, there commands an instinct of self-preservation, which manifests itself most unambiguously as an instinct for self-defense. Not to see many things, not to hear them, not to let them approach one. First piece of ingenuity, first proof that one is no accident but a necessity. The customary word for this self-defensive instinct is taste. Its imperative commands not only to say no when yes would be a piece of selflessness, but also to say no as little as possible. To separate oneself, to depart from that to which no would be required again and again. The rationale is that defensive expenditures, be they never so small, become a rule, a habit, lead to an extraordinary and perfectly superfluous impoverishment. Our largest expenditures are our most frequent small ones. Warding off, not letting come close, is an expenditure. One should not deceive oneself over this, a strength squandered on negative objectives. One can merely, through the constant need to ward off, become too weak any longer to defend oneself. Another form of sagacity and self-defense consists in reacting as seldom as possible and withdrawing from situations and relationships in which one would be condemned, as it were, to suspend one's freedom, one's initiative, and become a mere reagent. And lastly, from the I Ching. Every limitation has its value, but a limitation that requires persistent effort entails a cost of too much energy. When, however, the limitation is a natural one, as, for example, the limitation by which water flows only downhill, it necessarily leads to success, for then it means a saving of energy. The energy that otherwise would be consumed in a vain struggle with the object is applied wholly to the benefit of the matter in hand, and success is assured. Chapter 9. Turn the Tables. The Counterattack Strategy. Moving first, initiating the attack, will often put you at a disadvantage. You are exposing your strategy and limiting your options. Instead, discover the power of holding back and letting the other side move first, giving you the flexibility to counterattack from any angle. If your opponents are aggressive, bait them into a rash attack that will leave them in a weak position. Learn to use their impatience, their eagerness to get at you, as a way to throw them off balance and bring them down. In difficult moments, do not despair or retreat. Any situation can be turned around. If you learn how to hold back, waiting for the right moment to launch an unexpected counterattack, weakness can become strength. Disguised aggression. In September 1805, Napoleon Bonaparte faced the greatest crisis until that moment in his career. Austria and Russia had joined in an alliance against him. To the south, Austrian troops were attacking the French soldiers occupying northern Italy. To the east, the Austrian general Karl Mach was leading a large force into Bavaria. A sizable Russian army, under General Mikhail Kutuzov, was on its way to join Mach's army, and this allied force, once merged and expanded, would head for France. East of Vienna, more Russian and Austrian troops were waiting to be deployed wherever needed. Napoleon's armies were outnumbered 2-1. Napoleon's plan was to try to defeat each of the alliance's armies one by one, using his smaller but more mobile corps to fight them before they could join forces. While committing enough troops to produce a stalemate in Italy, he moved into Bavaria before Kutuzov could reach it and forced Mach's ignominious surrender at Ulm, with hardly a shot being fired. See Chapter 6. This bloodless victory was a masterpiece, but to exploit it to its fullest, Napoleon needed to catch Kutuzov before the Russian general could himself be reinforced by more Russian or Austrian troops. To that end, Napoleon sent the bulk of his army east toward Vienna, hoping to trap the retreating Russian forces. But the pursuit bogged down. The weather was bad. The French troops were tired. Their marshals made mistakes. And most important, the wily Kutuzov was cleverer in retreat than in attack. Managing to elude the French, he reached the town of Olmütz, northeast of Vienna, where the remaining Austro-Russian forces were stationed. Now the situation reversed. Suddenly it was Napoleon who was in grave danger. The strength of his corps was their mobility. Relatively small, they were vulnerable individually and worked best when operating close enough to one another to come fast to one another's support. Now they were dispersed in a long line from Munich to Vienna, which Napoleon had taken after his victory over Mach at Ulm. The men were hungry, tired, and short of supplies. The Austrians fighting the French in northern Italy had given up the battle there and were in retreat. But that put them heading northeast, posing a threat to Napoleon's southern flank. To the north, the Prussians, seeing that Napoleon was in trouble, were considering joining the alliance. If that happened, they could wreak havoc on Napoleon's extended lines of communication and supply, and the two armies moving in from north and south could squeeze him to death. Napoleon's options were abysmal. To continue the pursuit of Kutuzov would further extend his lines. Besides, the Russians and Austrians were now 90,000 strong and in an excellent position at Olmütz. To stay put, on the other hand, was to risk being slowly swallowed by armies on all sides. Retreat seemed the only solution, and it was what his generals advised. But with the weather deteriorating, it was mid-November, and the enemy sure to harass him, that would be costly too. And retreat would mean that his victory at Ulm had been wasted, a tremendous blow to the morale of his men. That would virtually invite the Prussians to join the war, and his enemies, the English, seeing him vulnerable, might go so far as to invade France. Whatever path he chose seemed to lead to disaster. For several days he went into deep thought, ignoring his advisers and poring over maps. Meanwhile, at Olmütz, the Austrian and Russian leaders, among them the Austrian Emperor Francis I and the young Tsar Alexander I, watched Napoleon's moves with intense curiosity and excitement. They had him where they wanted him. Surely they would be able to recoup the disaster at Ulm, and then some. On November 25th, Alliance scouts reported that Napoleon had moved a large part of his army to Austerlitz, halfway between Vienna and Olmütz. There it looked as if his forces were occupying the Pratzen Heights, a position that would indicate preparation for battle. But Napoleon had only some 50,000 men with him. He was outnumbered nearly 2-1. How could he hope to face the Allies? Even so, on November 27th, Francis I offered him an armistice. Napoleon was formidable, and even at those odds, fighting him was a risk. In truth, Francis was also trying to buy enough time to envelop the French army completely, but none of the Alliance generals thought Napoleon would fall for that trick. To their surprise, however, Napoleon seemed eager to come to terms. Suddenly the Tsar and his generals had a new thought. He was panicking, grasping at straws. That suspicion seemed borne out almost immediately when, on November 29th, Napoleon abandoned the Pratzen Heights almost as soon as he had taken them, assuming a position to their west and repeatedly repositioning his cavalry. He appeared utterly confused. The next day he asked for a meeting with the Tsar himself. Instead, the Tsar sent an emissary, who reported back that Napoleon had been unable to disguise his fear and doubt. He had seemed on edge, emotional, even distraught. The emissary's conditions for armistice had been harsh, and although Napoleon had not agreed to them, he had listened quietly, seeming chastened, even intimidated. This was music to the ears of the young Tsar, who was burning for his first engagement with Napoleon. He was tired of waiting. By abandoning the Pratzen Heights, Napoleon seemed to have put himself in a vulnerable position. His southern lines were weak, and his route of retreat, southwest toward Vienna, was exposed. An Allied army could take the Pratzen Heights, pivot south to break through that weak point in his lines and cut off his retreat, then move back north to surround his army and destroy him. Why wait? A better chance would never come. Tsar Alexander and his younger generals prevailed over the hesitant Austrian emperor and launched the attack. It began early on the morning of December 2nd. While two smaller divisions faced off against the French from the north, pinning them down, a stream of Russian and Austrian soldiers moved toward the Pratzen Heights, took them, then wheeled to the south, aiming at the French weak point. Although they met resistance from the outnumbered enemy, they quickly broke through and were soon able to take the key positions that would allow them to turn north and surround Napoleon. But at 9 o'clock a.m., as the last Alliance troops, some 60,000 men in all, made their way to the heights and headed south, word reached the Allied commanders that something unexpected was afoot. A large French force, invisible to them beyond the Pratzen Heights, was suddenly heading due east, straight for the town of Pratzen itself and the center of the Allied lines. Kutuzov saw the danger. The Allies had advanced so many men into the gap in the French lines that they had left their own center exposed. He tried to turn back the last troops heading south, but it was too late. By 11 o'clock a.m., the French had retaken the heights. Worse, French troops had come up from the southwest to reinforce the southern position and prevent the Allies from surrounding the French. Everything had turned around. Through the town of Pratzen, the French were now pouring through the Allied center and were swiftly moving to cut off the retreat of the Allied troops to their south. Each part of the Allied army, north, center, and south, was now effectively isolated from the others. The Russians, in the southernmost position, tried to retreat farther to the south, but thousands of them lost their lives in the frozen lakes and marshes in their path. By 5 o'clock p.m., the rout was complete and a truce was called. The Austro-Russian army had suffered terrible casualties, far more than the French. The defeat was so great that the alliance collapsed. The campaign was over. Somehow, Napoleon had snatched victory from defeat. Austerlitz was the greatest triumph of his career. Interpretation. In the crisis leading up to the Battle of Austerlitz, Napoleon's advisers and marshals had thought only of retreat. Sometimes it is better, they believed, to accept a setback willingly and go on the defensive. On the other side stood the Tsar and his allies, who had Napoleon weak. Whether they waited to envelop him or attacked right away, they were on the offensive. In the middle was Napoleon, who, as a strategist, stood far above both his own advisers and marshals on the one hand, and the Tsar and Alliance generals on the other. His superiority lay in the fluidity of his thinking. He did not conceive war in mutually exclusive terms of defense and offense. In his mind, they were inextricably linked. A defensive position was the perfect way to disguise an offensive maneuver, a counterattack. An offensive maneuver was often the best way to defend a weak position. What Napoleon orchestrated at Austerlitz was neither retreat nor attack, but something far more subtle and creative. He fused defense and offense to set up the perfect trap. First, having taken Vienna, Napoleon advanced to Austerlitz, apparently taking the offensive. That startled the Austrians and Russians, even though they still heavily outnumbered him. Next, he backed off and took a defensive position. Then he seemed to switch between offense and defense, giving every appearance of confusion. In his meeting with the Tsar's emissary, he seemed confused personally as well as strategically. It was all high drama, staged by Napoleon to make him look weak and vulnerable, inviting attack. These maneuvers fooled the Allies into giving up prudence, striking out at Napoleon with total abandon, and exposing themselves in the process. Their defensive position at Olmütz was so strong and dominant that only leaving it would ruin it. And that was precisely what Napoleon lured them into doing. Then, instead of defending himself against their rash attack, he suddenly switched to the offensive himself, the counterattack. In doing so, he altered the dynamic of the battle not only physically, but psychologically. When an attacking army suddenly has to go on the defensive, its spirit crumbles. And indeed, the Alliance troops panicked, retreating to the frozen lakes that Napoleon had intended as their graveyard all along. Most of us only know how to play either offensively or defensively. Either we go into attack mode, charging our targets in a desperate push to get what we want, or we try frantically to avoid conflict, and, if it is forced on us, to ward off our enemies as best we can. Neither approach works when it excludes the other. Making offense our rule, we create enemies and risk acting rashly and losing control of our own behavior. But constant defensiveness backs us into a corner, becomes a bad habit. In either case, we are predictable. Instead, consider a third option, the Napoleonic way. At times you seem vulnerable and defensive, getting your opponents to disregard you as a threat to lower their guard. When the moment is right and you sense an opening, you switch to the attack. Make your aggression controlled and your weakness a ploy to disguise your intentions. In a dangerous moment, when those around you see only doom and the need to retreat, that is when you smell an opportunity. By playing weak, you can seduce your aggressive enemies to come at you full throttle. Then catch them off guard by switching to the offense when they least expect it. Mixing offense and defense in this fluid fashion, you will stay one step ahead of your inflexible opponents. The best blows are the ones they never see coming. From The Art of War by Sun Tzu. However desperate the situation and circumstances, don't despair. When there is everything to fear, be unafraid. When surrounded by dangers, fear none of them. When without resources, depend on resourcefulness. When surprised, take the enemy itself by surprise. Jiu-Jitsu. In 1920, the Democratic Party nominated Ohio Governor James Cox as its candidate to succeed the retiring President Woodrow Wilson. At the same time, it named 38-year-old Franklin Delano Roosevelt as its vice presidential nominee. Roosevelt had served as the Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Wilson. More important, he was the cousin of Theodore Roosevelt, still very popular after his presidency in the first decade of the century. The Republican nominee was Warren G. Harding, and the campaign was a grueling affair. The Republicans had a lot of money. They avoided talking about the issues and played up Harding's folksy image. Cox and Roosevelt responded to the Republicans by going on a vigorous offensive, basing their campaign on a single issue of Wilson's, American participation in the League of Nations, which they hoped would bring peace and prosperity. Roosevelt campaigned all over the country, delivering speech after speech. The idea was to counter the Republicans' money with sheer effort. But the race was a disaster. Harding won the presidency in one of the biggest landslides in American electoral history. The following year, Roosevelt was stricken with polio and lost the use of his legs. Coming just after the disastrous 1920 campaign, his illness marked a turning point in his life. Suddenly made aware of his physical fragility and mortality, he retreated into himself and reassessed. The world of politics was vicious and violent. To win an election, people would do anything, stooping to all kinds of personal attacks. The public official moving in this world was under pressure to be as unscrupulous as everyone else and survive as best he could. But that approach did not suit Roosevelt personally, and took too much out of him physically. He decided to craft a different political style, one that would separate him from the crowd and give him a constant advantage. In 1932, after a stint as governor of New York, Roosevelt ran as the Democratic presidential nominee against the Republican incumbent, Herbert Hoover. The country was in the midst of the Depression, and Hoover seemed incapable of dealing with it. Given the weakness of his record, a defensive hand was a difficult one for him to play. And like the Democrats in 1920, he went vigorously on the offensive, attacking Roosevelt as a socialist. Roosevelt, in turn, traveled the country, speaking on his ideas for getting America out of the Depression. He didn't give many specifics, nor did he respond to Hoover's attacks directly. But he radiated confidence and ability. Hoover, meanwhile, seemed shrill and aggressive. The Depression would probably have doomed him to defeat whatever he did, but he lost far bigger than expected. The size of Roosevelt's victory, nearly an electoral sweep, surprised one and all. In the weeks following the election, Roosevelt essentially hid from public view. Slowly, his enemies on the right began to use his absence to attack him, circulating speculation that he was unprepared for the challenge of the job. The criticisms became pointed and aggressive. At his inauguration, however, Roosevelt gave a rousing speech, and in his first months in office, now known as the 100 Days, he switched from the appearance of inactivity to a powerful offensive, hurrying through legislation that made the country feel as if something were finally being done. The sniping died. Over the next few years, this pattern repeatedly recurred. Roosevelt would face resistance. The Supreme Court, say, would overturn his programs. And enemies on all sides, Senator Huey Long and labor leader John L. Lewis on the left, Father Charles Coughlin and wealthy businessmen on the right, would launch hostile campaigns in the press. Roosevelt would retreat, ceding the spotlight. In his absence, the attacks would seem to pick up steam, and his advisers would panic. But Roosevelt was just biding his time. Eventually, he knew, people would tire of these endless attacks and accusations, particularly because, by refusing to reply to them, he made them inevitably one-sided. Then, usually a month or two before election time, he would go on the offensive, defending his record and attacking his opponents suddenly and vigorously enough to catch them all off guard. The timing would also jolt the public, winning him their attention. In the periods when Roosevelt was silent, his opponents' attacks would grow and grow more shrill. But that only gave him material he could use later, taking advantage of their hysteria to make them ridiculous. The most famous example of this came in 1944, when that year's Republican presidential nominee Thomas Dewey launched a series of personal attacks on Roosevelt, questioning the activities of his wife, his sons, and even his dog, the Scotch Terrier Falla, whom Dewey accused of being pampered at the taxpayers' expense. Roosevelt countered in a campaign speech, "The Republican leaders have not been content to make personal attacks upon me, or my sons. They now include my little dog, Falla. Unlike the members of my family, Falla resents this. When he learned that the Republican fiction writers had concocted a story that I left him behind on an illusion island and had sent a destroyer back to find him, at a cost to the taxpayers of $2 or $3 or $8 or $20 million, his Scotch soul was furious. He has not been the same dog since. I am accustomed to hearing malicious falsehoods about myself, but I think I have the right to object to libelous statements about my dog." Devastatingly funny, the speech was also ruthlessly effective. And how could his opponents reply to it when it quoted their own words right back at them? Year after year, Roosevelt's opponents exhausted themselves attacking him, scoring points at moments when it didn't matter, and losing one landslide election after another to him. Interpretation. Roosevelt could not bear to feel cornered, to have no options. This was partly because of his flexible nature. He preferred to bend to circumstances, changing direction effortlessly as needed. It also came out of his physical limitations. He hated to feel hemmed in and helpless. Early on, when Roosevelt campaigned in the usual aggressive way of American politics, arguing his case and attacking his opponents, he felt hopelessly constricted. Through experiment, he learned the power of holding back. Now he let his opponents make the first move. Whether by attacking him or by detailing their own positions, they would expose themselves, giving him openings to use their own words against them later on. By staying silent under their attacks, he would goad them into going too far. Nothing is more infuriating than engaging with someone and getting no response, and ending up shrill and irrational, which played badly with the public. Once their own aggression had made them vulnerable, Roosevelt would come in for the kill. Roosevelt's style can be likened to jiu-jitsu, the Japanese art of self-defense. In jiu-jitsu, a fighter baits opponents by staying calm and patient, getting them to make the first aggressive move. As they come at the fighter and either strike at him or grab hold of him, either push or pull, the fighter moves with them, using their strength against them. As he deftly steps forward or back at the right moment, the force of their own momentum throws them off balance. Often they actually fall. And even if they don't, they leave themselves vulnerable to a counterblow. their aggression becomes their weakness, for it commits them to an obvious attack, exposing their strategy and making it hard for them to stop. In politics, jiu-jitsu style yields endless benefits. It gives you the ability to fight without seeming aggressive. It saves energy, for your opponents tire while you stay above the fray. And it widens your options, allowing you to build on what they give you. Aggression is deceptive. It inherently hides weakness. Aggressors cannot control their emotions. They cannot wait for the right moment, cannot try different approaches, cannot stop to think about how to take their enemies by surprise. In that first wave of aggression, they seem strong, but the longer their attack goes on, the clearer their underlying weakness and insecurity become. It is easy to give in to impatience and make the first move, but there is more strength in holding back, patiently letting the other person make the play. That inner strength will almost always prevail over outward aggression. Time is on your side. Make your counterattacks swift and sudden, like the cat who creeps on padded paws to suddenly pounce on its prey. Make jiu-jitsu your style in almost everything you do. It is your way of responding to aggression in everyday life, your way of facing circumstances. Let events come to you, saving valuable time and energy for those brief moments when you blaze with the counterattack. By Vladimir Lenin. The soundest strategy in war is to postpone operations until the moral disintegration of the enemy renders the delivery of the mortal blow both possible and easy. Keys to Warfare. Thousands of years ago, at the dawn of military history, various strategists in different cultures noticed a peculiar phenomenon. In battle, the side that was on the defensive often won in the end. There seemed to be several reasons for this. First, once the aggressor went on the attack, he had no more surprises in store. The defender could clearly see his strategy and take protective action. Second, if the defender could somehow turn back this initial attack, the aggressor would be left in a weak position. His army was disorganized and exhausted. It requires more energy to take land than to hold it. If the defenders could take advantage of this weakness to deliver a counterblow, they could often force the aggressor to retreat. Based on these observations, the art of the counterattack was developed. Its basic tenets were to let the enemy make the first move, actively baiting him into an aggressive attack that would expend his energy and unbalance his lines, then taking advantage of his weakness and disorganization. This art was refined by theorists such as Sun Tzu and practiced to perfection by leaders like Philip of Macedon. The counterattack is, in fact, the origin of modern strategy, the first real example of an indirect approach to war. It represents a major breakthrough in thinking. Instead of being brutal and direct, the counterattack is subtle and deceptive, using the enemy's energy and aggression to bring about his downfall. Although it is one of the oldest and most basic strategies in warfare, it remains in many ways the most effective and has proven highly adaptable to modern conditions. It is the strategy choice of Napoleon Bonaparte, T.E. Lawrence, Erwin Rommel, and Mao Zedong. The counterattack principle is infinitely applicable to any competitive environment or form of conflict, since it is based on certain truths of human nature. We are inherently impatient creatures. We find it hard to wait. We want our desires to be satisfied as quickly as possible. This is a tremendous weakness, for it means that in any given situation, we often commit ourselves without enough thought. In charging ahead, we limit our options and get ourselves into trouble. Patience, on the other hand, particularly in war, pays unlimited dividends. It allows us to sniff out opportunities, to time a counterblow that will catch the enemy by surprise. A person who can lie back and wait for the right moment to take action will almost always have an advantage over those who give in to their natural impatience. The first step in mastering the counterattack is to master yourself, and particularly the tendency to grow emotional in conflict. When the great baseball player Ted Williams made the major leagues with the Boston Red Sox, he took a look around. He was now a member of an elite, the best hitters in the country. They all had sharp vision, quick reflexes, and strong arms. But relatively few of them could control their impatience at the plate. And pitchers preyed on that weakness, getting them to swing on losing pitches. Williams separated himself out and made himself perhaps the greatest pure hitter in baseball history by developing his patience and a kind of hitter's counterattack. He would wait and keep waiting for the best pitch to swing at. Good pitchers are masters at making a hitter feel frustrated and emotional, but Williams would not be baited. Whatever they did, he would wait for the pitch that was right for him. In fact, he turned the situation around. Given his ability to wait, it was the pitcher, not Williams, who would end up impatient and throwing the wrong pitch as a result. Once you learn patience, your options suddenly expand. Instead of wearing yourself out in little wars, you can save your energy for the right moment, take advantage of other people's mistakes, and think clearly in difficult situations. You will see opportunities for counterattack where others see only surrender or retreat. The key to the successful counterattack is staying calm while your opponent gets frustrated and irritable. In 16th century Japan, there emerged a novel way of fighting called shinkage. The swordsman would begin the fight by mirroring his opponent's every move, copying his every footstep, every blink, every gesture, every twitch. This would drive the enemy crazy, for he would be unable to read the shinkage samurai's moves or get any sense of what he was up to. At some point, he would lose patience and strike out, lowering his guard. The shinkage samurai would inevitably parry this attack and follow up with a fatal counterblow. Shinkage samurai believed that the advantage in a life-and-death sword fight lay not in aggression, but in passivity. By mirroring their enemy's moves, they could understand his strategy and thinking. By being calm and observant, patient, they could detect when their opponent had decided to attack. The moment would register in his eyes, or in a slight movement of his hands. The more irritated he became, and the harder he tried to hit the shinkage fighter, the greater his imbalance and vulnerability. Shinkage samurai were virtually unbeatable. Mirroring people, giving back to them just what they give you, is a powerful method of counterattack. In daily life, mirroring and passivity can charm people, flattering them into lowering their defenses and opening themselves to attack. It can also irritate and discomfort them. Their thoughts become yours. You are feeding off them like a vampire, your passive front disguising the control you are exercising over their minds. Meanwhile, you are giving them nothing of yourself. They cannot see through you. Your counterattack will come as a complete surprise to them. The counterattack is a particularly effective strategy against what might be called the barbarian, the man or woman who is especially aggressive by nature. Do not be intimidated by these types. They are in fact weak and are easily swayed and deceived. The trick is to goad them by playing weak or stupid while dangling in front of them the prospect of easy gains. During the era of the warring states in ancient China, the state of Qi found itself threatened by the powerful armies of the state of Wei. The Qi general consulted the famous strategist Sun Bin, a descendant of Sun Tzu himself, who told him that the Wei general looked down on the armies of Qi, believing that their soldiers were cowards. That, said Sun Bin, was the key to victory. He proposed a plan. Enter Wei territory with a large army and make thousands of campfires. The next day, make half that number of campfires, and the day after that, half that number again. Putting his trust in Sun Bin, the Qi general did as he was told. The Wei general, of course, was carefully monitoring the invasion, and he noted the dwindling campfires. Given his predisposition to see the Qi soldiers as cowards, what could this mean but that they were defecting? He would advance with his cavalry and crush this weak army. His infantry would follow, and they would march into Qi itself. Sun Bin, hearing of the approaching Wei cavalry and calculating how fast they were moving, retreated and stationed the Qi army in a narrow pass in the mountains. He had a large tree cut down and stripped of its bark, then wrote on the bare log, "The general of Wei will die at this tree." He set the log in the path of the pursuing Wei army, then hid archers on both sides of the pass. In the middle of the night, the Wei general, at the head of his cavalry, reached the place where the log blocked the road. Something was written on it. He ordered a torch lit to read it. The torchlight was the signal and the lure. The Qi archers rained arrows on the trapped Wei horsemen. The Wei general, realizing he had been tricked, killed himself. Sun Bin based his baiting of the Wei general on his knowledge of the man's personality, which was arrogant and violent. By turning these qualities to his advantage, encouraging his enemy's greed and aggression, Sun Bin could control the man's mind. "You too should look for the emotion that your enemies are least able to manage, then bring it to the surface. With a little work on your part, they will lay themselves open to your counterattack." In our own time, the family therapist Jay Haley has observed that for many difficult people, acting out is a strategy, a method of control. They give themselves the license to be impossible and neurotic. If you react by getting angry and trying to make them stop, you are doing just what they want. They are engaging your emotions and dominating your attention. If, on the other hand, you simply let them run amok, you put them still more in control. But Haley discovered that if you encourage their difficult behavior, agree with their paranoid ideas, and push them to go further, you turn the dynamic around. This is not what they want or expect. Now they're doing what you want, which takes the fun out of it. It is the jiu-jitsu strategy. You are using their energy against them. In general, encouraging people to follow their natural direction, to give in to their greed or neuroses, will give you more control over them than active resistance will. Either they get themselves into terrible trouble, or they become hopelessly confused, all of which plays into your hands. Whenever you find yourself on the defensive and in trouble, the greatest danger is the impulse to overreact. You will often exaggerate your enemy's strength, seeing yourself as weaker than is actually the case. A key principle of counterattack is never to see a situation as hopeless. No matter how strong your enemies seem, they have vulnerabilities you can prey upon and use to develop a counterattack. Your own weakness can become a strength if you play it right. With a little clever manipulation, you can always turn things around. That is how you must look at every apparent problem and difficulty. An enemy seems powerful because he has a particular strength or advantage. Maybe it's money and resources. Maybe it's the size of his army or of his territory. Maybe, more subtly, it's his moral standing and reputation. Whatever his strength might be, it is actually a potential weakness, simply because he relies on it. Neutralize it, and he is vulnerable. Your task is to put him in a situation in which he cannot use his advantage. In 480 BC, when the Persian king Xerxes invaded Greece, he had a huge advantage in the size of his army, and particularly his navy. But the Athenian general Themistocles was able to turn that strength into weakness. He lured the Persian fleet into the narrow straits off the island of Salamis. In these choppy, difficult waters, the very size of the fleet, its apparent strength, became a nightmare. It was completely unable to maneuver. The Greeks counterattacked and destroyed it, ending the invasion. If your opponent's advantage comes from a superior style of fighting, the best way to neutralize it is to learn from it, adapting it to your own purposes. In the 19th century, the Apaches of the American Southwest were, for many years, able to torment U.S. troops through guerrilla-style tactics that were perfectly suited to the terrain. Nothing seemed to work until General George Crook hired disaffected Apaches to teach him their way of fighting and serve as scouts. Adapting their style of warfare, Crook neutralized the Apaches' strengths and finally defeated them. As you neutralize your enemy's strengths, you must similarly reverse your own weaknesses. If your forces are small, for example, they are also mobile. Use that mobility to counterattack. Perhaps your reputation is lower than your opponent's. That just means you have less to lose. Sling mud. Some of it will stick, and gradually your enemy will sink to your level. Always find ways to turn your weakness to advantage. Difficulties with other people are inevitable. You must be willing to defend yourself and sometimes to take the offensive. The modern dilemma is that taking the offensive is unacceptable today. Attack, and your reputation will suffer. You will find yourself politically isolated, and you will create enemies and resistance. The counterattack is the answer. Let your enemy make the first move, then play the victim. Without overt manipulation on your part, you can control your opponent's minds. Bait them into a rash attack. When it ends up in disaster, they will have only themselves to blame, and everyone around them will blame them too. You win both the battle of appearances and the battle on the field. Very few strategies offer such flexibility and power. Reversal. The counterattack strategy cannot be applied in every situation. There will always be times when it is better to initiate the attack yourself, gaining control by putting your opponents on the defensive before they have time to think. Look at the details of the situation. If the enemy is too smart to lose patience and attack you, or if you have too much to lose by waiting, go on the offensive. It is also usually best to vary your methods, always having more than one strategy to draw on. If your enemies think you always wait to counterattack, you have the perfect setup for moving first and surprising them. So mix things up. Watch the situation and make it impossible for your opponents to predict what you will do. Here are further reflections on the counterattack strategy. From a 17th century Ming Dynasty text quoted in The Tao of Spycraft by Ralph D. Sawyer. The technique of according with the enemy's expectations and desires requires first determining what they believe and want, then apparently conforming to them until a situation can be exploited. Definition. When the enemy wants to take something and you yield it, it is termed according with. In general, when going contrary to something merely solidifies it, it is better to accord with it in order to lead them to flaws. If the enemy wants to advance, be completely flexible and display weakness in order to induce an advance. If the enemy wants to withdraw, disperse and open an escape route for their retreat. If the enemy is relying upon a strong front, establish your own front lines far off, solidly assuming a defensive posture in order to observe their arrogance. If the enemy relies upon their awesomeness, be emptily respectful, but substantially plan while awaiting their laxness. Draw them forward and cover them. Release and capture them. Exploit their arrogance. Capitalize on their laxity. By Carl von Clausewitz. A rapid, powerful transition to the attack, the glinting sword of vengeance, is the most brilliant moment of the defense. From History of the Art of War in the Middle Ages by Sir Charles Oman. A sudden inspiration then came to William at the Battle of Hastings, A.D. 1066, suggested by the disaster which had befallen the English right in the first conflict. He determined to try the expedient of a feigned flight, a stratagem not unknown to Bretons and Normans of earlier ages. By his orders, a considerable portion of the assailants suddenly wheeled about and retired in seeming disorder. The English thought, with more excuse on this occasion than on the last, that the enemy was indeed routed, and for the second time a great body of them broke the line and rushed after the retreating squadrons. When they were well on their way down the slope, William repeated his former procedure. The intact portion of his host fell upon the flanks of the pursuers, while those who had simulated flight faced about and attacked them in front. The result was again a foregone conclusion. The disordered men of the feared were hewn to pieces, and few or none of them escaped back to their comrades on the height. From The Wiles of War, 36 Military Strategies from Ancient China. When the enemy finds itself in a predicament and wants to engage us in a decisive battle, wait. When it is advantageous for the enemy but not for us to fight, wait. When it is expedient to remain still and whoever moves first will fall into danger, wait. When two enemies are engaged in a fight that will result in defeat or injury, wait. When the enemy forces, though numerous, suffer from mistrust and tend to plot against one another, wait. When the enemy commander, though wise, is handicapped by some of his cohorts, wait. From Secrets of the Samurai by Oscar Rotti and Adele Westbrook. These two main principles of application are specifically related to the tactical value assigned